So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Well, welcome to this second episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
And I don't know about you, David, but I'm having a great time.
Oh, it's a blast.
Isn't it?
It's great, yeah.
And it looks like the plan is coming together.
Yes.
It is possible for us to have real, spontaneous conversations with friends who are veterans in recovery. We can record them and we can share them with thousands of other new friends who are starting on this road. Some of them have been on the road a long time.
Yeah, what a great thing technology is, right?
Yeah. Well, David, I don't know how many of our listeners know that you are a lifelong professional musician.
I am.
Yeah. Although you made a career change 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, I did. I started embarking on it a few years ago, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you are now a certified professional recovery coach.
I am.
In Nashville.
Yeah.
You were an active addict at times during your musical career?
Most of the time. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Anywhere I could squeeze it in. I was
And now you find that the artist community in Nashville is not immune from addiction.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Nashville's an exciting place because there are also some really wonderful active nonprofit organizations that will help musicians in seeking sobriety and seeking help. And I have a real privilege in getting to partner with those organizations from time to time. And in doing that, I end up meeting some really great friends who are now in sobriety and have just become really super people in my own life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I love is how many in the artist community really now are veterans of recovery,
mm-hmm.
Who have just charged into that way of life, leaving all their reservations behind, and they are giving it away. They've learned that to keep it, we have to give it away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we're adding those people to the guest list on this podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of those we got coming in this week, you may not know his name, but you do know his songs, most likely. A whole bunch of number one hits. And what cracks me up is that this guy is recovering alcoholic. One of his credits is Red Solo Cup.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, but he's written for everybody from Keith Urban and Tim McGraw and Faith Hill and Dierks Bentley to
Blake Shelton and on and on.
Lynyrd Skynyrd, for Pete's sake.
Yeah.
And he's just a delight to be with, which you are gonna find out for yourself as we open the door and welcome Brad Warren.
Welcome to Positive Sobriety, and today our guest is Brad Warren, and Brad is a friend of mine and a Nashville songwriter, part of a country music duo, the Warren Brothers, with he and his brother Brett. They are songwriters, and you've probably heard a number of their songs by other people, performed by other people, Faith Hill and Tim McGraw and Blake Shelton and Dierks Bentley, and on the list goes. And Brad has been very successful in that area, and he's been also very successful in taking on some hard things in his life. And we're here to talk today about just the positive aspects of what it's been like to be Brad as a sober version. So, Brad, welcome. Welcome to our podcast and for being our guest. This is really fun, and I'm kind of probably going to forget that we are being recorded, and we'll just talk like we would next to each other on an airplane or something. But tell me a little bit about your background. How did you get into music and discover that that was a part of your giftedness?
I grew up in a musical family and didn't realize it was a musical family. I thought everyone had to take piano lessons and all those things. But Brett and I have two sisters. My brother Brett is my duo partner in the Warren Brothers. And we have two older sisters who are amazing musicians. And our parents both played and sang. And we started with playing in church, ironically enough.
Yeah.
Doesn't everyone? And I played multiple instruments in church. And as a little kid, trumpet and drums and bass and guitar and whatever. And then when I was 11 years old, I heard Sweet Home Alabama on the radio. And I was like, oh, I want to do that, whatever that is.
That sounds more fun.
Absolutely. And so I started playing guitar when I was 11, and then and I started writing songs early, too. And I'm not saying they were good. I'm just saying I wrote them. But 12, 13 years old, I was writing a full set of, like, our little junior high school rock band's material. And, I didn't even know this was a job, to be honest, when I was growing up writing songs for other people. But it's been a huge blessing to have this career in my life, and I love it now.
Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. Well, as you discovered more about your songwriting abilities, that took you into a lot of places that you probably had the opportunity to perform and also be introduced to some other temptations in life or ways to discover that you could also feel enhanced, maybe a way to put that.
That's a new word for it.
Is that good? I always felt enhanced, at least for a while. When did you discover your relationship with substances?
It's ironic because as the young rock band, excuse me, that Brett and I became, as the young rock band, we really didn't. We didn't use that much. We played like Christian rock bands, and I was in my 20s. It wasn't like an early start, and I'll never forget the first week. I drank like twice in high school, but not to drunkenness, and the first time I ever was around enough alcohol to get really drunk, I drank every bit of it and got sick, and it was horrendous, and I didn't touch it again for years, so I was, 22, 23 years old before I had really gotten into it. And it was gradual. It was just kind of gradual. And I was never an everyday user of substance. I was a binger. Mm-hmm. Once I started, I couldn't stop. 10 wasn't enough. 1 was too many. Mm-hmm. And so I never thought I was an alcoholic because I could go days without drinking. I would go days without drinking. But then when it came on, and gradually it's kind of like the frog in the pot of boiling water. By the time I realized what a problem it was kind of too late. I mean, I'm sober now, which is great. But at the moment it was like, I knew there was a big problem. It was years later that I actually got sober and found recovery because, it had become a habit.
Mm-hmm.
And, drugs, they go so well with alcohol. It's amazing, like cookies and cream.
Uh-huh.
So before I knew it, drugs were an every week at least part of the alcohol abuse, and it had just gone down a really, really negative road. And I mean, my wife, who I'm still married to, unbelievably hung in there. But what a bear I must have been, because I'm a little bit of a bear sober. It was a big problem, and when I hit my rock bottom, I was grateful for it. Mm-hmm. It was time to get out.
Yeah, can you talk about what rock bottom looked like for you, or is that too personal?
Absolutely not. I can not too personal. I mean, so I was in California. We spent like a week in Los Angeles. A friend of ours was shooting a movie, and we were on the set writing songs, and we were like this little bit part in this little bit movie. as the band in the background of a scene.
Wow.
And I was just in all what should have been all of our glory in a house with a bunch of other musicians and a box full of drugs and a refrigerator full of alcohol. Mm. And I just couldn't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. It was, my wife had just called me and very calmly told me that she had had enough and that she wished well for me and that she would try to help me get into rehab, but she was done. And, you know, the leading up to that was just lies every day.
Right.
If you asked me how much money was in my pocket and I had $10, I'd tell you five just to lie.
Yeah.
I just wanted to practice, I guess. Stay in shape. And it was just lies.
Right.
And it's exhausting. It's yeah. just exhausting. And so beyond the substance abuse, it was the self-centeredness and the lack of surrender to a higher power. And it really wasn't this, because I had done a few bouts of tough it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm white knuckling, not drinking. And that's miserable.
Yeah.
That's not drinking is miserable. Drinking is miserable. Recovery is great.
Yeah.
And I had to find out what recovery was. And that's an active program. It took some action. Still
right.
does.
Right.
And it's not really what I thought it was. It's actually way better. Mm-hmm. But if you had described it to me at the time, it
right.
wouldn't have seemed all that. I have to do how much? How many meetings?
Yeah.
And call people and let people call me just randomly that need help and
right.
actually help them. And it wouldn't have seemed attractive then and is the only way to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and, you know, we always say that alcohol or substances aren't your problem. They're your favorite solution that no longer works. What did you discover as you entered sobriety and early sobriety to be your problem, so to speak?
Whew. I mean, I have to say my problem is me. And that sounds really general and kind of generic, but every instinct I have tends to be wrong. I work with my brother, obviously. It's a songwriting duo, so a lot, almost every day. And occasionally I'll go on an opposite month, and I'm just, whatever my instinct is, I'm just going with the opposite. Like, uh-huh. if I think that's a bad idea, I'm going to say, it's a great idea. Let's do it.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you are so much easier to work with on opposite month. You know? So much had to change. We describe ourselves in AA as the piece of garbage that the world revolved around.
Yeah.
And I was definitely that egomaniac with a self-esteem problem.
Right.
And I had to change so much, and I'm glad I didn't see the whole road, the whole path I was going to have to take, because it would have seemed insurmountable. But
right.
Starting with that one relationship with my wife, and becoming honest with her and becoming a servant to her in emotional ways and just whatever, including her in the decisions of our house that would have fallen apart many times without her, started enabling me to interact that way with my children.
Mm-hmm.
And have an honest interaction with them and to be peaceful and not very, very impatient, short-tempered, just everything you can imagine that would be lead you to being an alcoholic. I have all of them, mm-hmm. all the gifts, all the great gifts. And so it just kind of, and honestly, it's been 13 years. So it's been a minute, but if I don't stay in tune with my relationship with God and serene and do a little bit of breathing mm-hmm. during the day and, mm-hmm. and realizing who's in charge. I heard a great thing the other day. The difference between you and God is that God doesn't think he's you.
Yeah.
I thought that was a good one.
That is
but,
good.
Realizing that has been really helpful. And so today, at least when I'm getting manic, I know the causes, and that's just self coming out. And the less Brad around, the better Brad is.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, I heard an Anne Lamott quote recently that said that or I read it, can't remember, but she said the way you know that you are creating God in your image is when God doesn't like the same people you don't. And of course, Anne's a sister in recovery with us as well. But that's good. And so how did it impact you spiritually coming into this whole new way of thinking and being?
Drastically. I grew up in a really strict Southern Baptist church, full of speaking in tongues, laying on of hands. So it was a real hodgepodge of Baptist. We called it Baptomatic. It was kind of Baptist charismatic. And no alcohol, no cussing, no anything.
Right.
Great Christian people in a way. And also I was raised, it was almost cult-like judgment. We were a very critical family. It's just something that we were taught, and I was very critical of you, of me, of everything, all the time. Mm-hmm. So my spiritual Christianity was a chore, and it was judgmental, and it was unkind, and it was something that you had to do. But I had, you know, hung on to it for my first 20 years of life, and then the next 15, I really ventured, and I didn't like either guy. Uh-huh. So my spirituality became something that has been enhanced by the rooms of recovery, because I needed a non-judgmental spirituality. I needed someone that just, I'm broken.
Right.
I surrender. Well, what do I do now? And not try to look good, or not try to make yourself appear better than you are, or not show off your spirituality, but just really need it. Mm-hmm. I was broken in half. I wasn't broken a little bit. I was just absolutely broken in half. Mm-hmm. And that's when I found spirituality. And so I found it's funny because I still go to church. My wife is Catholic, so now I go to Catholic church, and I have for a long time with her. And I love it. There's some great people there, and we had great experiences. But this recovery has been my spiritual change. And
right.
It was just because of the surrender and the honesty. It was wonderful to just go through a day and not be lying all the time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that appealed to me when I first got into the rooms was the fact that people had complete permission to be who they are in that moment, and they didn't have to perform. Everybody kind of knew that phase or that stage, or that whether it's an early stage of sobriety or whether it's a time where we're trying to reclaim our control and we're fighting like hell again to get it back, and you know, all the things that go on in all of us. But it seemed like there was this permission, and I didn't have to feel on when I was in that room. I didn't have to feel like God was waiting for me to be profound, or that I had to be okay so other people could be okay, or that there was a particularly right ideology that if I didn't adhere to it, somehow I was going to be on the outside and the fringe of it, and not quite as much of a sober person as other people. And so I found that to be really a refreshing place, and it in turn gave myself a lot of permission to ask a lot of questions about how I watched God working in the lives of other people. So that was a huge shift for me, just watching people who didn't identify themselves the same way that I did, having profound experiences spiritually with surrender and letting go and telling the truth. You know, what a concept.
I feel like sometimes that God doesn't give a crap about 80% of what we're worried about in church, in organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to get to the core of it. It's not behavior related. The behavior follows the heart.
Right.
And my heart was out long before my behavior went there. But I was just kind of longing for something wrong. And then my heart was back in recovery before my body got in recovery. I'm like, all right, I'm never doing this again. And
yeah.
Of course, that's famous last words.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's... it's like when your willingness is out in front of your ability, it happens. When those things have to line up, and that really just happens for me, and I think probably for you, when we're just broken into nothing.
Right.
Like, wow, I really can't control this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the person I was raised to be. This is bad news. And then 2 more years.
Yeah, people come to me in practice. I'm in private practice as an addiction recovery coach and sobriety coach. And excuse me, I find that they're surprised that they have come in to talk about a substance or a compulsive behavior, and I want to talk about a belief system. I want to talk about who they believe themselves to be, who they have to present to the world. Is that a true version of themselves, would they say? And most of the time it's not. And what are we willing to let go of in order to experience authenticity so that we don't have to drink at ourselves, at God, at excuse me, at other people, and all those kinds of things. So that's always interesting to people coming in, that that's not the first thing. We're not going to sit down and talk behavior. We're not going to talk about symptomology. We're going to talk about causality. And to do that, we've got to talk about how we believe and what we believe about ourselves.
Well, let me brag on you for a minute, because I know you in that capacity too. And that is, you're absolutely amazing at okay, you understand recovery. And we do that. We get that in rooms of recovery. But you bring in that causality. And it's really amazing. You do, I don't know if you get told that enough. But
Well, thank you.
But really, truly, that's... That's something that you have brought into my awareness and helped my family with, just understanding that there's a cause behind these things. These aren't just random actions, and they don't, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day, and neither was a good program.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one day at a time and one step at a time, and you're really helping a lot of people in that area.
Well,
so thank you.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that. Thank you. So as you embarked on sobriety, did you... like some of us feel, did you feel like, okay, I'm going to get sober, my life's going to get better?
At the moment when I got sober, I didn't really care. I was desperate.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to live. Mm. It was so, it was bad. I had enough bottom, and it wasn't, you know, physically I could feel myself, the drugs and alcohol taking their effect. Hangovers were really bad.
Mm-hmm.
My relationship with everyone was bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, you know, it's ironic because you mentioned our career was, you know, we were a duo and then now we are songwriters. But that was the transition, because, which has been a very good one.
Mm-hmm.
But the transition was, I don't care about being a rock star anymore at all. I don't mm-hmm. care about anything. I got to get sober.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to be right, mm-hmm. honest with myself, whatever it was. It's pretty, mm-hmm. it's pretty raunchy. Physically, spiritually, emotionally, everything was bad. And because of that, learning how to lose a little bit of self, came upon a career that was not something that I had really desired before, which is so much better than, as I now approach 50 years old, which is better than anything I could have possibly imagined
mm-hmm.
As a recording artist. And that was just, and you know, I think God does for us things that we wouldn't choose at the time, which is why I'm, you know, all these things are lessons, but would have never had this career if I hadn't become sober, because I never would have accepted the role of being a guy that helped other artists get where they wanted to go. I wanted other people to help me get where I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's a service industry, what we do. And we mm-hmm. work with artists and for them, and try to help them get where they want to go and write the songs that they need to use for expression. And without recovery, no.
Yeah.
Was not interested in where you wanted to go. And it didn't matter who you were. I just wasn't interested. I wanted to feel good,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to have fun, and I wanted you to make me feel like that was okay. That's it.
Co-sign it for me. And
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe bring some drugs along.
Yeah.
You know, if you can.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That?
Well, so would... how would you say becoming as you grew in your sobriety, how did that impact your creative process? Because so much of the time, you know, I mean, everything's new and raw, and as we get sober, doing things without the help of substances, did you struggle with confidence in your material at any point? Like, I used to write pretty well when I was a little tanked or a little stoned, but I don't know if I can really do that very well now.
Yes, I love that question, because it's a really funny story. So before we got sober, we had written zero hits mm-hmm. for ourselves or anyone else, but mm-hmm. we had written records for ourselves and tried to write no hits,
mm-hmm.
no actual commercial success. A few things that entered the Billboard chart, but nothing that was that you would call a hit.
Mm-hmm.
None, zero, my whole life. So, you know, up to 35 years old,
mm-hmm.
nothing. And we got sober, and I was like, oh my God, well, I'll never be able to write again, because alcohol and the party surrounded everything I'd ever written. It's over. I can't ever be creative again because I was protecting with all my might that zero hit career that I had going, you know, protecting that perfect
right.
batting average.
Yeah.
And ironically, since that moment, so for the past 13 years, Brett and I have been fortunate enough to write a bunch of hits
mm-hmm.
and a bunch of cuts. And it's been amazing. And by the way, do we still draw from our experiences back then? Yes. And good and bad. You know,
sure.
We did spend 6 months writing about nothing but recovery. the word sober was in every song at some
yeah.
point. But then you get back into it and start writing about drinking again as well, which to the chagrin of my mother. But it opened everything up. Stephen King, who's one of us, it's mm-hmm. in one of his books called On Writing. And I'm not a huge fan of Stephen King's books because he scares me and I'm a real big sissy. When it comes to that, but he's got a book called On Writing about just the process of writing. And he said one of the great misnomers of all time is that alcohol and drugs enhance the creative
right.
process. It's crap. And everything about being an artist, a writer, a creator is way better sober than, and I hate to break it to all the stone millennials that think they're changing the world, but as for me as uh-huh. a creator, nothing replaces just complete honesty and surrender. And I think everyone does their best work when they're of sound mind, and
mm-hmm.
at least I do.
Yeah. Well, and so you have this now a pretty impressive, if I might say, catalog of material that, you know, lots and lots of people have done. And if we said names of songs, people would go, oh, yeah, absolutely. As that increased and that there came some rewards with that, right? I mean, financially and so on and so forth. What if that had happened to you prior to sobriety?
That is a good question. I've thought about that a few times. Well, I think that if I had any financial actual stability, much less excess, as a user, that I would at least be divorced,
mm-hmm.
which would have changed everything. I would be completely miserable, and
mm-hmm.
and that would be terrible for me, my children, and my poor ex-wife. I used to actually say to my wife, a little side bit, I say, if you think I'm a bad husband, you just wait and see what kind of ex-husband I'm going to make. That was one of my go-tos.
There's incentive to stay
yeah,
married right there, folks.
You know, it could be worse. So I would be at least divorced. Whatever mistakes I have made as a parent would have been compounded by many times. And I very well may be dead,
mm-hmm.
physically dead, just
mm-hmm.
because the access to substance and the lack of having to get up and go stroke it out, make a living. It's funny because as a person before recovery, I always looked at work as work. And now I look at work as opportunity. It's
mm-hmm.
I get to go to work. I don't have to go to work.
Right.
I get to go make, yeah, are there times that it's difficult? There's some mental ditch digging in the songwriting business.
Well, that's why it's called a craft,
yeah, exactly.
right?
And
it's
so
not
it doesn't
magic.
Mean that it's easy, but
yeah.
I get to go to work. I don't have to. And so I'm grateful for many things, but I think any sort of financial stability, even before sobriety, would have been a negative thing.
Mm-hmm. And in the rash of, you know, recent losses we've experienced with artists and very gifted people, I've heard over and over, you know, the worst thing that can happen to an addict is success. I don't know. I don't want to speak for God, but maybe in some kind of severe mercy that yours got held in the file till
Absolutely.
You were ready for it, maybe. I don't know.
I've had that very feeling before. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what has, and this may be a weird question, but I like to ask it because I like to ask weird questions. What has been, or has there been, anything about sobriety that at first was disillusioning to you?
Yeah, there's a thing they call the pink cloud syndrome. I've experienced that. And so there were moments of just, and this was before any sort of career or financial success had a chance to happen, but just absolute bliss and the idea that I'm honest with myself and my wife and family, and I'm healthy, and I'm happy, and I'm working out during the days, and I quit smoking, and I'm just going to be, it's just going to be the cell. And then that, at some point, real life happens, and so there's a disillusionment, and the idea that pink cloud syndrome of perfection in life, you are going to have to deal with crap. The difference is today I look at the crap as an opportunity. God is trying to teach me something, and I'm like, I want to learn it this time, because if not, he's going to give me another dose of this later to learn something else. And all of the rough times, and there have been more than one in sobriety, some things that I would have handled really badly but all of those things have given me opportunity to give back to someone, because I have been in a place where I can talk to someone else and go, actually, I know exactly how you feel right now. Because my family got to go through this and this and this. And had I not gone through it, I really wouldn't have that much empathy for that person, sadly. Right. So God needed for me to go through some stuff in sobriety to make me available to people that I needed to be available to for service and help.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, because after the miracle, we often experience that pink cloud, and we experience, why did I put this off? This is awesome. How did I, think I couldn't live with this? But then we realize that we have maybe treated people in a way that we have to, of course, the steps, and we have to go back and we have to make amends, and we do some unpleasant things, and some unpleasant conversations and experiences are required of us in many ways. And so as we approach those things, then the shine wears off a little bit more. But then we begin to realize that we've trained people to treat us a certain way, and certain people in our lives have taken on certain roles, and our sobriety disrupts that. Did you experience that?
Yes. There was a piece of gratitude in the moment that my wife saw that I was serious about this and I was going, but there definitely were some unhealthy is probably the best word to use, just unhealthy relationships and unhealthy avenues in each relationship that I had kind of set up in that way to kind of, keep Slick alive. We call Slick the little alcoholic guy on there. I want to make sure Slick was protected. So I always, by the way, I don't sleep well. So I always would say, I don't sleep well. So if I happen to stay up all night because I've been using drugs, it wouldn't seem like anything strange, just because I don't sleep well. So that's why I'm tired the next day. Well, I would even do that in sobriety. I would be sober, but I would start protecting what mood I was going to be in later to family or... that's a small example, but a lot of little unhealthy things that have, by the way, it's progress, not perfection in our deal, but it's definitely a lot cleaner than it was.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you guys experience, roles where, for instance, maybe your wife, trusting this process at first, and maybe I expected a parade. I'll speak for myself here. I expected a parade and nobody gave me one. I knew they were building a float in the backyard that they were going to bring out one day, and I was going to get to ride it, through the neighborhood, probably around my first sobriety birthday, right? And there was no float. There was no pinata. There was no cupcake.
I've heard that before. I had a little bit of that. I did, emotionally beat my chest a few times. Come on. I'm Gandhi. I got this. But I will say that I was such a bastard. I hope I'm allowed to say that. I was such a jerk before coming in that I never really expected a parade. I'm like, wow, this is, I can actually be grateful for every single thing in my life, which I could be grateful for nothing two kinds of people, by the way. People who are grateful for nothing and people who are grateful for everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had to jump on the other boat. So I don't think that I experienced as much of that as I would have someone else. But my wife also was very, she wasn't going to Al-Anon or anything, but she's very supportive of the, to this day, is very supportive of the recovery process. She will say, hey, you're getting kind of manic. Why don't you go to a meeting? I'm like, oh, you got this figured out now, don't you?
Yeah.
And she's always right when that comes to it. So, yeah, there were times when I kind of felt like I needed a parade, but there were other times when I felt like there's an older lady that we were friends with, and still, 13 years later, she sends me a box of cookies. She lives out of state now on my sober birthday.
Oh, that's awesome.
And just how proud she is of me. And I'm like, I haven't talked to you in a year. You know, I could be drinking by now. But, so yeah, I probably internalized that a little bit more than I externalized it to my wife. Hey, where's my party?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't even do chips just because I get a little thing when I start doing mile markers, I'll wind up getting to 15 years or 20 years and feel like I've accomplished something.
Yeah. Yeah. So. That's interesting. And you know, because I've had people, say that as well. And, I have kind of adopted that, because it appealed to my perfectionism. You know, I mean, as an addict, I was such all or nothing thinking, and I still fight all or nothing thinking. You know, it's either just, you know, the best thing in the world, or it's, you know, all gone to shit, and we all have, you know, and it's, there's not any real in between. And I've learned that life is lived in between. Everything is in between. Nothing is, you know, all anything. But somehow that, you know, that 11 year, 12 year, 13 year chip somehow felt like, that it appealed to that, I don't want to not get my chip. I don't want to, you know, I got to get my chip, or I'm going to go get my, you know, and it wasn't like the chips were, you know, redeemable in $10,000, you know, cash advances or anything. It was just that it somehow appealed to my perfectionism, and so I just realized that there was way too much emphasis, maybe, putting on that. And
yeah,
some people might
disagree. There was going to be a lifetime achievement award at the end of like this 15-year chip, and I was going to reward myself with a bottle of something. You know, it's like,
yeah.
No, I better just stay away from this.
Yeah. The lifetime achievement award is that I got to live the rest of my life.
Yeah.
I think that's the lifetime achievement award. But yeah, you were talking about gratitude, and I was just wondering how that. How do you experience that and demonstrate that in your own life?
It is such a choice. Gratitude is such a choice because you can. I've learned this by being around. I feel like I've been able to see things on the high end of life and the low end of life at extremes a little bit, and then, you know, I'm during my long slow climb to the middle. It's gratitude's a choice. You can get used to almost anything.
Yeah.
That's good or bad.
Yeah.
I get used to the nice house or the swallow.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't ever met anyone who doesn't have a reason to be grateful. Mm-hmm. So, and certainly for myself, like when we had this guy that worked in our crew when we used to be a band, and he said, look, man, if you're reincarnated, you're a right-handed white male that gets to play music for a living. You're not coming back as anything. You know, this is as fortunate as you get.
This is about as good. Yeah,
you're a right-handed guitar player.
Yeah, in this culture, that's about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and he said, you know, and it's funny, but you can find a reason to be angry about anything.
Yeah,
I mean, traffic.
Yeah,
it's hysterical that's still kind of. It's not a trigger for me, but it's a barometer.
Yeah.
If I'm mad at people driving in traffic who are either in less of a hurry or more than a hurry than me, the problem's with me.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing in the Daily Reflections that talks about this old couple in a car, and they're driving. The guy behind him is just, you know, just up their bumper trying to get them to move, and he's just pissed because he's trying to get somewhere. And if you draw back from that 30,000 feet, it's just an old couple with their grandkid in the back enjoying a Saturday drive, just enjoying their life. And this guy that's rushing is... Mm-hmm. late for something insignificant that he should have left the house earlier for, and the alcoholic being the guy in the driver's seat in the rear car. If I can just pull myself back a little bit and look at that, it's a lot easier to get through the day. So I can choose to, like, I'll leave here today because we just talked about this, and I'll be super grateful for a couple hours. and then I'll be, so it is, it's a progress, not perfection thing, but it is a choice. It's an everyday choice. And when I'm thinking about it of right mind and in the right frame of mind, I'm grateful for everything. I'm the luckiest guy on planet Earth. Mm-hmm. And when I forget that and start being ungrateful for anything, it's time for me to shift the tude.
Yeah. Yeah. I had an interesting conversation. I'll abbreviate the story for now, but with a homeless man that walked down my street. I moved into downtown back earlier this year and into this nice security building that, is in a what would have otherwise years ago been a part of town you wouldn't have walked at night in. But unfortunately and fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the addicted and the mentally ill did not go away when they came in with these nice places to live for other people to enjoy. And that's been a really good experience for me because I've gotten to have conversations with people I never encountered in the suburbs of Williamson County, living in the Nashville area. And this homeless man, I was walking my dog about 10:30 at night, and it's just about a month ago. And he came up, and he was trying to get to the rescue mission, and he was on a bike, and the bike just looked like it was held together with rubber bands. I mean, it was, and his worldly possessions were in this bag, hanging from the handlebars of this bike. And he asked for cash because he hadn't eaten in a couple of days. And I, being in recovery and doing what I do for a living now, I can pretty well tell when people are lit or not. Yeah. I'm
pretty good
meter pegs pretty well when people come in and they're, they say they're fine and they're not. And he really seemed clear-headed, very, articulate and easy to talk to and not agitated. And he just was hungry. And I, I never carry cash. I feel terrible, but I don't. And so one thing led to another, and I don't recommend this, but I gave him a ride to go with me down to the ATM, took my dog in, went and got my car, said, wait right here, lock your bike up, go, get some money. On the way down there, I asked him, introduced myself, he introduced himself, and I call him Tommy. I said, Tommy, do you mind if I ask how you got in this situation where you're living from behind this place to behind this place to behind this place? He said, no. He said, I witnessed my dad murder my mom and cause trauma, and this happened and this happened. I was supposed to go to college, but the money went to attorneys. I ended up using some drugs, so I ended up selling some drugs, and then I ended up in jail, and then I ended up violating probation, and then, one thing led to another. But he said, I've been sober 8 years. In the process, he had had a wife that had passed away. And he said, I have been sober 8 years, and right now I'm just trying to get my life back. And I'm just trying to get to the rescue mission. I just want to eat on the way, and the rescue mission is just, maybe another mile down the road from where I live. And I said, how have you managed to stay sober for 8 years? And he said, oh, man, he said, every day I start out my day with a list of things that I'm grateful for and all my blessings. And my sarcastic ass is sitting over in the driver's seat going, that's got to be a short list. That would not take me long, Tommy, if I were sitting where you sit. And he said, yeah, he said, I've got a bike and I woke up and nobody injured me at night. I got to stay in the same place without being hurt. And today I'm going to get on my bike and I'm going to go out and I'm going to find another way to see what God provides for me until I can get to the next thing. And I'm grateful for it. And every day I start out and that's what I do. And you talk about feeling like, a spiritually shriveled up, I think I'm grateful. But I'm, good grief. I mean, I can lose it over a parking space. Mm-hmm. And, I used to joke when I was drinking that two red lights was enough of a reason to, you know, go home and need a hit. And so anyway, just ever since, even just that few weeks ago of experience talking to this guy, I have been so intentional about not missing the piece of gratitude with the people I work with myself, because that, you know, if you can be homeless and carry the belongings you have in a knapsack hanging from the bars of a bike that looks like it's about to fall into pieces, and you can wake up behind a Little Caesars and be grateful, I think maybe we could, the rest of us, have a shot.
Yeah, there's a pattern. It's something that I have to be careful about in recovery, just for myself. But you get sober, you get your shat together, you have a little success, and you become a diva. and you get addicted to comfort instead of, you know, drugs. And that is the gratitude will keep you, at least me, grounded in a way that I'm not gonna be grounded and have, like, if a active addict can't handle success, recovering addict's got to be careful about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, success can come in all different forms. I'm certainly, there's people on way on it. There's always somebody, what is it? There's always somebody richer, smarter, better looking. You know what I mean? No matter who you are.
Right.
And that keeping that in mind and the lack of control and realizing that, okay, God's in control of this, and I can't really protect myself from discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you really want a pad. I want to put pads between me and any kind of discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just really want to make sure that I'm not, you know, sleeping on the wrong side of the bed, and I'm my car is air conditioning, and that I've, you know, and then there's a guy on a bike held together by duct tape who finds a way to be grateful every morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great lesson. I'm glad you told me that story.
Yeah. Well, it changed me, and it impacted me. I think that gratitude is something that we just cannot miss, because we are all tremendously blessed to be here, to be sober, to have people in our lives that have hung with us and loved us and continue to. And I'm so encouraged that you and your wife are so weathering all that, and that you're on a good place, and that's encouraging to a lot of people. And thank you so much again for making time to come and just visit with us.
Thanks for having me. You are a great guy, and there's nothing I wouldn't do for you. And this has been fun. And any time.
Likewise, I appreciate that.
And I figure Nate was scared of me, so that's why he didn't show up today.
Nate is on the road today. That's why we're soloing it. And thanks for mentioning Nate, because
they didn't even know he wasn't here. By the way,
they didn't miss him. They don't. You know, I mean, who knew? We would until you said that. No one was all the wiser. But yeah, Nate is out on the road today, taking the Samson Society on the road, I believe, and taking recovery to some guys in some different states and doing some speaking and all of that. But man, thank you so much. This has been so fun.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We will look forward to having you back, I hope.
Yes.
So
100%.
All right. Well, thanks again, Brad Warren. Appreciate it. Well, Nate, we missed having you on that episode. It was such a great time for Brad and I. It was like 45 minutes flew by.
Yeah. It killed me that I wasn't in the room, but I was off doing other important stuff. And
you were.
Some great people, yeah.
Yeah, you were out in the Southlands with some other guys doing some great stuff.
Just gallivanting.
Yeah.
That's all. Just gallivanting.
But Brad brought a lot of his story to bear in ways to me that highlighted his gratitude and his generosity and what he is investing himself in now.
Yeah.
That he, you know, was so good about explaining that just wasn't an option for him when he was active.
Well, hey, listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Anything, a message you'd like us to pass along to Brad, any thoughts you have, If you want to chime in, if you want to push back, if you want to comment, you can send us an email at positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com. Or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page. Do like our Facebook page, and you can help push us to the top of the rankings on iTunes by giving this podcast a good, solid 5-star rating there. You can tweet to your friends. These are good, helpful conversations. This is a great gift to give to anybody in recovery or anybody considering walking into the world of recovery. So do help us there. Well, I think that time has flown, and it's about time for us to say goodbye for this week, but we've got a great guest coming up next week. Make sure you join us next week on the Positive Sobriety Podcast when our guest will be filmmaker Skip Stokes.
Can't wait.
The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.